Hi, I'm Bede Hill, and this is The D Word, the show where we talk dementia. Welcome along to a very special D Word, number 300 since we started in June 2019. Over 6 years, I've been lucky enough to talk to people all over the world to learn about the amazing work which is going on, and also I've been privileged to meet so many people living with dementia. When it came to show 300, I didn't have to think hard about what I wanted to do. I started watching football with my dad in the 1960s, and the game has been a major part of my life ever since, working in sports media and supporting my favourite teams. Sadly, though, those that played the beautiful game have paid a high price. Five of England's 1966 World Cup winning team died whilst living with dementia, and former professionals are receiving a diagnosis with alarming regularity. One of them is Roy Heaney, who will be joining me after the song that started it all off.
Someone play the honky-tonk guitar.
Mississippi by Pussycat, especially for Catherine. My guest this week is Roy Heaney, who is part of a unique group who played both football and rugby league at the highest level. Well, Roy, it's a real pleasure to have you here as my guest on the D Word. Dementia and football, two worlds I'm very much involved in. So really looking forward to this. First of all, tell us a little bit about your story. You signed as a schoolboy for Liverpool.
I did, yeah, in 1975, all those years ago. Doesn't feel that long ago, but many years ago, 1975, I signed as a schoolboy. I'd been playing for my city team from the age of 11, Liverpool schoolboys, through to when Liverpool picked me up. It was either them or Everton, and I'm a true red, so it was never going to be the blue side, or it was going to be the red side. So, yeah, it was a dream come true, to be honest. And I think they had high hopes for me. I was asked as a 15-year-old to give up my school holidays and go and train with the first team, which I did for 6 weeks. And it was a dream come true, as you can imagine, training and getting changed and playing alongside Keegan, Toshak, Highway, Callaghan, Smith, all heroes of mine. Tommy Smith in particular was you know, my idol as a defender, the Anfield Iron. And yeah, it was a dream come true. And it looked, you know, I thought at that stage you never think you've made it because you're still only a kid on schoolboy forms. But I thought, you know, so far so good, and I thought my trajectory was going to be onwards and upwards. But unfortunately, in the first game I played in the youth team, it was against Tranmere Rovers in the youth team game, I had a really bad break, broke my leg in my very first game, and it was quite a bad break. And I remember before going down to surgery, the great Bob Paisley was at the hospital to see me, and he said, chin up, son, you know, don't worry about it, we'll see you back in Anfield. And I remember being terrified. I thought, oh my god, you know, how bad is this? Anyway, it took me about a year to recover, and Liverpool obviously supported me really well. I used to train facilities for that full year and try and get myself back to some form of fitness, although obviously not match fit. And I had just turned 16, going on to 17, and it was that time when clubs had to make a decision whether they were going to sign you on apprenticeship forms in those days. And Liverpool decided that the break had been a bad one. It was actually on the growth plate. So I think they thought my career was done and I was too much of a risk, really. And I went in and asked for my apprenticeship. And I remember Tom Saunders, who was the youth team coach then, saying, you know, I'm sorry, son, but you know, we can't take a chance. It was such a bad break. You're never going to get your strength in the tackle back, and you know it's going to affect your speed. We have to let you go. So as you can imagine, as a 15-year-old, that was my world had just come crashing down, you know. And I had no bad feelings to Liverpool, although it just shows that even in those days, in 76 at that time, football has always been a very ruthless, hard enterprise, business. It's a business. And I just think they didn't see me as an investment that was going to bring them back any returns, and that injury was going to finish me. So they called it a day. And for months, I thought, you know, my world had collapsed. What was I going to do? I was bright, but I hadn't really concentrated on my education. Football was the only thing I wanted to do. I slept and drank it, so what do I do? And luckily for me, I kept on playing. I was just playing Saturday league, Sunday league football, and a couple of clubs had come in to watch me, West Brom, Bolton Wanderers, and Bolton asked me to go down for a trial, which I jumped at the chance. And had a couple of games, and they had no hesitation. They offered me a contract and said, you know, they thought I was so good defensively, strength in the tackle, and my pace, my speed. So they signed me for the reasons that Liverpool let me go. But I sat, I signed on the dotted. Then a year later, I signed my first professional contract with the club. And at that stage, Bolton were a really good side. We're in the old Division One, which is the Premier League now. And I played along some great players there, European Cup winners, and Tony Dunn, Brian Kidd, Frank Worthington was there then, great player. Sam Allardyce played alongside Sam, and still a good friend of mine to this day, Paul Jones. We had a really good side. We did well for a couple of years, and I was in and outside, to be honest. And as a young 21-year-old lad, I was probably a little bit, I wasn't patient enough, and I thought, well, yeah, put me in regularly, or I want first team football somewhere else. So I put myself on the transfer list, and a couple of clubs came in. Again, West Brom were interested, even Everton showed a little bit of interest, but out of the blue, one of the directors at Bolton was also a director at Wigan Warriors, and he said, look, we really think you'd be great. It would be great if you changed codes. We think you'd be ideal for Wigan. As a winger, you're really quick, you're strong. The transition won't be easy because you've never, obviously, never played rugby in your life before. But it's a challenge, and they made me a really good financial offer. And I was 21 years of age. I had a young daughter, and I was married at the time. I thought, well, the challenge and the offer, I thought, yeah, I'll go to Wigan. So I did that, and I played at Wigan for 2 years. I was mostly in the first team, scored a few tries. But I noticed probably the second year that the game then was a totally different game, as football is now and rugby league. Rugby league was, how can I put this? It was absolutely barbaric at times. High tackles were allowed, clothesline tackles were allowed. You're going into battle. You wasn't going into play a game. You're going into battle most of the time. But I was a tough lad anyway, and I got on with it. And again, Wigan changed the manager. New manager came in. I was making some strange decisions, which I'll get back to in a bit, but I was making some quite strange choices at the time as a 23, 24-year-old. And Salford had come in and said, Salford said, look, we don't we value you. You're sort of in and out the team at the moment. What do you think about coming to Salford? And again, to this day, I don't regret it, but it's something that I really shouldn't have done. I should have stayed at Wigan, and I went to Salford.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimising your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance and more. Benefit from the power, purity and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And I was there for about 18 months until a high tackle, basically, under the chin, knocked me unconscious, fell awkwardly, and completely severed my cruciate ligaments. And in 1982-83, there was really no way back then. You know, the surgeries were sort of a lot different to where they are now, and ended up with a 10-inch scar on the knee. And that was the end of my career, or so I thought. And I went out of rugby league. And then my dad, being absolutely devastated, phoned up the rugby authorities and said, look, you know, my son's a professional rugby league player, he's a professional footballer, his career's over. You know, no one's been in touch with him. What happens? And they said, oh, the only way we pay people out, Mr. Heaney, is if, to me, Dad, is if you're carried out in a pine box. And that was the exact words they said to me, Dad. You know, my dad was broken hearted, absolutely devastated. We thought that was it. Again, I fought back. I got myself to some level of fitness, although I was... The knee injury I'd sustained had changed my game. Speed wasn't there then, definitely not. You know, gone to a fair bit, but could still play. And I was offered the opportunity to go to New Zealand as a player manager in a town called Whanganui, a club called Whanganui Athletic. And I went there at the age of 25. So I was playing manager at 25, had a really good start. Everything was going really well. They were paying me in a sense where I would work for some of the local authorities and some of the private schools. I'd coach, I'd get, they'd pay me. The club would get paid and then the club would pay me out of that. Fortunately, I had more issues with my knee, was out for about 3 months, and the club decided that they didn't have the revenue to carry on paying me. So after a year in New Zealand, that was the end. So I came back and knew I was struggling. Knew it was, you know, I needed to look probably as a coaching. So the PFA helped me. I got my FA UEFA full license. I was coaching and playing for Workington semi-professionally for a while, and then locally in Liverpool, Prescott Cables, Bootle FC. But I was starting to have other issues, which we'll talk about in length, obviously, shortly. But I retired at the age of 30, basically. Then, you know, again, still not ready to go into life outside sport, which is really difficult. I thought, what am I going to do? Where am I, you know, where's my life going to go? I was bright, so I went to university. I got a social work degree and I ended up working for Liverpool City Council in children and families as a social worker for 5 years, and then I transitioned over to mental health and worked in the Liverpool mental health crisis team for 3 years. Loved those jobs. Again, as time was wearing on, I was noticing the physical issues were always there, but I was having cognitive problems from the age of 40 onwards, really. Some before that, some Parkinsonian issues that I was having in my, I'd say, late 20s, early 30s. But that, again, that got worse as I got into my 40s, and the cognitive issues really started then, plus mood and other issues. So I retired with ill health in the end, but because of the physical problems I was having and the mental health issues as a social worker. And from there, you know, I was always still trying to find my way back into employment, which I did. Sometimes I did lots of jobs, in and out of different jobs. Eventually, my wife and I bought a pub in Preston. And we had three young children. It was absolutely crazy decision when I look back. Three kids under three, bought a pub, and working all hours God sends. That's a tough business as well. And sadly, it didn't work out, and we ended. The business went to the wall, really, after about just over a year. And I've been retired ever since, really. So, and then the cognitive issues started to set in.
Sure.
But that's my career details.
Okay, there's a book in that, Roy.
Lots it's to pick out, yeah.
Yeah, if you haven't already started writing it.
I but have, yeah.
I mean, those cognitive things that you're talking about, sort of late 20s and then really beginning to show in your 40s. I mean, what persuaded you eventually to go and try and get a diagnosis?
Well, I think the issue started to get worse. It started, as I say, with I'd had tremors. I'd had them in my 20s, and almost like involuntary arm or leg movements, where I would lose control of my arm or the leg, or you know, I'd drop a drink out of nowhere. I used to get really low, really depressed at times. And that would fluctuate, you know, in and out of moods. I was having times which not my personality at all. I was struggling to keep my temper at times. I wouldn't take much to set me off into a rage, and at times that really bothered me because I thought this is not me. You know, it's not who I am. So I was having lots of difficulties. The memory issues really started, I would say, in my I was in my early 50s onwards, and they progressively got worse to the point in, I guess, 2021, which would make me 61. I had gone to an ex-player's charity lunch at Bolton Wanderers, and I was talking to Big Sam Allardyce, and another friend of mine, Paul Jones, and Paul was having issues of his own, and I said to Paul, you know, we were sort of sharing our stories. And Paul said, "Look, here's a number. Contact them. You need help. You need to get a diagnosis because obviously you're having similar issues to me." So I took this number, and well, I didn't realise it was. I thought it was a doctor's number, or you're right, it was a solicitor's number, and it was Rylance Garth who are looking after over 1,000 of us now in professional football, amateur football, and amateur rugby and professional rugby. So they've taken the case on. So I phoned them and said, "Look, you know, I've been giving you a number. What can you do? I've heard about the case. What can you do for me? It's, you know, it's not the case I'm interested in, but I am struggling. And I'd heard they were getting diagnosis, hopefully trying to get a diagnosis for people." So they sent me to Cardiff for a very specialised MRI. It's called a diffusion technique. Forget all the words, but it's something to do with the imaging technique is totally different to any other MRI. There's only two in the country, one in London, one in Cardiff. So I had the MRI, and then they made me had four neuropsychological tests and exams, the MRI took a while to come back. The exams weren't going well, and there was a suggestion of CTE that was brought up. But I heard about that in 2018 because I'd already had my GP had sent me to see a neurologist in 2018, and they did an MRI which showed some white matter deficiency problems in my brain, and they suggest in 2018 that it may have CTE, but it was never followed up, Pete. So it was never followed up, but there was a suggestion then before it had even gone legal. So that was the suggestions anyway after seeing the neurologist. But once the MRI come back, there really wasn't any doubt. It showed significant brain damage in the front lobe and in other areas. Where there'd been brain bleeds, so it had bleeds on the brain, which I wasn't aware of, I could think, but I remember some of the, you know, really bad head injuries I'd had, and not to mention the many thousands of subconcussive hits as a footballer and a rugby league player, but I can remember the likes of, you know, I mean, one game against Leeds United. I ended up with six stitches just above my eye and then a broken jaw. Both separate incidents, and carried on playing. You, in those days, You just, you didn't come off unless your leg was falling off, basically. And we didn't want, let's be honest, as professional players as well, you want your place. You know, as my kids, you want to give your best regardless of whether you're injured or not. So, but that should have been taken out of my hands. It never was, and there was lots of times, broken noses, at least four broken noses, as I say, broken jaw, broken eye socket. Most of them head injuries after the initial leg problems I'd had. So it was all adding up. And they came back, seeing urologists who read, went through the report with me, and he said he had no doubt that it was probable chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and possibly at that time they thought Alzheimer's.
Everywhere. Along with being introduced to football in the 1960s, I also started my love of the Beatles, and it's even more appropriate as my guest this week is Roy Heaney, who of course was born in Liverpool.
The thing with CTE is, once you have CTE, usually there's another diagnosis in there, whether that be motor neuron disease, Alzheimer's, Lewy body, dementia or Alzheimer's dementia. There's lots of, so many different types of dementias out there, as you know. So it's dual diagnosis, basically, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And at that time, they thought Alzheimer's. That's changed since. But I was really grateful for the opportunity. I had to go private. I'd been referred by my GP, but I'd already been waiting a year before. I'd heard nothing back from them. Eventually, 2 years later, the NHS get in touch with me and say, we'd like you to come for tests. So this is 2 years after a referral, which is, for me, worked most of my life. And lots of people out there, not just me, lots of people like me in the same boat, many thousands of people like me in the same boat, shouldn't have to wait 2 years with this awful disease before you're seen by anyone. I think that's absolutely diabolical of the NHS. So that's where it was, and the neurologist at the NHS said, could I see all your I don't want you to go through all these tests. You've already had them. I had more than we would do on you. Can you show me the results? So I sent him the results, and he agreed with the diagnosis, said yes, definitely, probably chronic traumatic encephalopathy and CTE and maybe Alzheimer's. That's changed because of the symptoms that I've been showing. I've seen an abnormal nurse through through the PFA who suggested that given the symptoms that I'm having, I have visual hallucinations a lot. My sleep is affected constantly. Wake up and I don't know whether I'm in the dream or whether it's reality. I was leaving the house the other morning at 4 a.m. because I had this awful dream that wasn't real. I won't go into the detail, but it wasn't real. It was something that I dreamt and I really believed was real. And I was leaving the house and my wife had to basically come downstairs and put me back into the house. Forgot how to walk up the stairs. You know, I just forgot the actual dynamics of how you walk up the stairs. My two girls were there. That helped me up the stairs. You know, that was a bad moment. We're all in tears. And then we end up laughing afterwards. But lots of different issues. And not just about memory. Memory, my short-term memory is non-existent now, Pete, to be honest. Long-term, God, I can remember back, you know, so many years as a footballer. Some of it's cloudy, obviously, but my memory long-term is really good. Short-term memory is just awful. And that's developing, and obviously the symptoms are changing. So still, I'm still in flux in a sense because, I still haven't had that diagnosis. They're saying, yeah, it could be Alzheimer's, could be Lewy body. It's definitely a dementia. We're not sure which one. And the NHS just aren't stepping up. They've now said, what you have is incurable. It's incurable and it's untreatable. So we won't be intervening. So that's been really hard for me to hear that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with your career, everything that happened, I'm guessing late 70s, early 80s, then yeah. CTE's letters weren't really anybody thought of. Nobody had probably mentioned the words Alzheimer's. Yeah. Well, I want to go to 2002 because that was a fundamental year in terms of CTE because that was the year that sadly Jeff Astle passed.
Yeah.
And the coroner classed CTE at that point as an industrial injury relating to his job as a professional footballer. And, it's 23 years since that happened. Mm. And and a lot of others seem to be examples of exactly what that coroner was talking about.
It is, and that's the disappointing side, Pete, for me. That's the really disappointing side. I mean, you can go back there. You go back to the 1930s, and they, boxers, the slang word was punch drunk. They get punch drunk, but it was called, they named it in those days. I think it was pugilistic dementia, it was called, which is CTE. So they knew in the 1930s CTE, because they just called it a different name. So as times developed, and, even in my time, I look back and I look back at some of the older pros before me who were suffering with dementia. Bob Paisley, my manager at Liverpool when I was a kid, Bob ended up with dementia, So many. Bobby Robson, another great player, great manager, dementia. I actually went to a seminar in Liverpool. I just got my full license and Bobby was giving a talk. It broke my heart. I'll never forget it because it broke my heart at the time. He didn't know what city he was in. He forgot what he was trying to say. In the end, they basically had to take the mic off and help him. He was in such a state. And I looked at that then. You never think that's going to be you. You never think that's going to happen to you. And he certainly was in the late stages probably CTE and dementia then, and we're still trying to do a job, still trying to operate in football, and it was just impossible. So it's been there for a long, long time, Pete. You're right, a long time. And the authorities have known about it for such a long time. They're gradually now beginning to put protocols in place. Still not perfect, still a way to go, but they're putting protocols in place that are beginning to help future athletes and athletes who are playing the game now. Still a long way to go. But those protocols just were not there, Pete. They weren't there. And as you say, the damage was being done over that period into the 2000s and later. And this is the tip of the iceberg, the actual tip of the iceberg. There's so many of us come forward now. There are a lot more who are yet to suffer from this disease. And I personally, no, I've lost four colleagues through who've taken their own lives. Whether CTE was a part of that, I can't pin my hat on it, but they were all suffering from depression, anxiety, didn't want to live, couldn't cope with the issues they were having with themselves. And four of those lads took their own lives, one of them an England international. And, you know, this is not new. It's been going for years. And the Premier League now is a multi-million pound organisation. When I played, you know, we weren't millionaires then. We played for the love of the sport, not because the wage packet was going to make us a millionaire. We played because that was our dreams. We were living out our dreams. But I'm sorry to say that there just was no level of care or support for players then, in either sport, whether that be football or rugby league, you know, or rugby union for that matter, any rugby sport. And we've obviously seen what happened in America in the early 2000s with the NFL and the players, you know, players over there who took their own lives for similar reasons. And obviously the outcome was the NFL settled out of court, because you cannot argue with the science, Pete. Can't argue with the science. As you say, the science has been out there for many, many years, and yet we're still dilly-dallying, and we're still, you know, the authorities still aren't considering the long-term brain health of the players.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, looking at the NFL example, 1 billion over 65 years is the NFL example, and that is for players and past players. What seems to be happening in this country is that, yeah, you're right, there have been protocols put in and people are looking forward, but there seems to be a terrific lack of looking in the opposite direction for ex-pros like yourself. And even the fact, I mean, Jeff Astor, 2002, there was a report commissioned which finally saw the late light of day 14 years later and didn't tell anybody much. And then there was another report which actually said that ex-pros are 3.5 times more likely to suffer from neurodegenerative disease than the standard population.
The PFA, they're sort of in a difficult position because they support professionals now and professionals from years ago, but they're still part of the football community. So, you know, they're really doing their utmost to help us. They've given me an opportunity to go to the Brain Clinic in London to get further tests and hopefully get the support I need off the NHS. They're going to try and get me the support that way. So the knowledge is, it's all over football. The Professional Footballers Association, which is the Football Union, the Football Association, UEFA, they all have this information. They all know what this awful disease does, and they know how and if they can prevent it. Or I don't believe that'll ever happen. I don't think you can ever prevent head injuries in contact sport, but what you can do is limit the damage. You can limit the damage, you can take it out of training, because when I played, obviously we trained like we played, so you know, I'm broken nose at least twice in training. And, you know, that doesn't go on to the same extent, but there are still, you know, the head and the footballs, that goes on continually. And for me, you know, I digress a little bit, but when I look back, I was heading a ball at an elite level in training programs as a Liverpool schoolboy from the age of 11. So my brain, obviously everyone's brain, doesn't stop developing until he's 21. So the damage we did in those early years and later years has been catastrophic. And the knowledge was, as you say, the knowledge was there, even so much so that it's now, you know, it was in Dawn's case and in Jeff's case, it's an industrial disease. So why they're not taking responsibility? Why they not, for me, standing up and saying, look, we got it wrong. We know we got it wrong. Sadly, there are many who have passed and many who are struggling with this disease. We're going to do our best to make sure that we limit the amount of head injuries and we limit the amount of contact in sport during training and otherwise to make sure that this doesn't become an epidemic, because it already is an epidemic. It already is, Pete. It's an epidemic. And I think, you know, at the moment, we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. Sadly, we're running out of time. And I'll tell you, I want to make this part one because I want to get you back on to talk about a lot of other stuff as well, because I think it's a really big story, and it's something that, you know, I only played at schoolboy level and park level, but I've been a football fan all my life. I've been involved in sports media, and it's something that, you know, it's close to my heart. So firstly, thank you for coming on. I want to blow the half-time whistle, if that's all right, and then we'll get you back for part two and we'll talk some more. But for now, Roy, thank you so much for being my guest.
You're welcome. It's been an honour. Thank you so much, Pete. I appreciate it.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places still can recall. Some are dead and some are living. In my life, I've loved them all. But of all these friends and lovers, there is no one compares with you. And these memories lose their meaning, and I think of love as something new. Though I know I'll never lose affection for people and things that went before, I know I'll often stop and think about them. In my life, I love you more.
Couldn't think of a better song to round off episode 300 of The D Word than In My Life by The Beatles. Thanks to Roy for joining me on part one of the Football and Dementia special, and he'll be back in a couple of weeks for part two. Well, that's it, and as you can guess, a lot of thank yous to make for people who've made the last 300 episodes possible. Joanna Raffaella at UK Health Radio for believing in a show about dementia and their friendship and support. To Angela, my invaluable production assistant. Laurie LeBay for being there with Alzheimer's Speaks, really giving me the idea for the D Word. To all the amazing guests from all over the world and everyone who's listened, joined in on social media and connected on LinkedIn. Couldn't do it without you. So here's to the next 300, starting next week with a look at the latest Alzheimer's report from Alzheimer's Disease International with my guest, Chloe Benoit. So until then, thanks for listening and take care now.